Happy holidays and welcome back for a new episode of Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Barnage. The election is over dozens of times in favor of President-elect Joe Biden, culminating with the Electoral College officially voting for him. However, that's not enough closure for the current occupant of the White House. President Trump is still ranting about unfounded fraud, and he's even started floating the idea of not leaving on Inauguration Day, as stipulated in the Constitution. Worse still, he reportedly met with pardoned former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn about putting martial law in place to redo the election in those battleground states where he lost. It's using that backdrop that today's guest joins me. Dr. Bandy Lee is an acclaimed psychiatrist who explores the increasingly erratic behavior of the president. Joining me right now is Bandy Lee. She is a faculty member in the Law and Psychiatry Division at Yale School of Medicine, and also part of the 2017 book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. That was a compilation of essays by numerous mental health professionals. Dr. Bandy Lee, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to delve into the assessment of President Trump, but first, given the situation that we've seen since the election, the president's failure to recognize his election defeat, are you learning more about his quote-unquote condition?
Well, there was just a lot of information to start. So if you were asking if anything was surprising or unpredicted, no.
So it just outlined what you already knew. It didn't make it even more dramatic. If we look back, and I want to ask you about that, it basically just put an accentuation over it.
Yes. In fact, I was interviewed right before the election results were announced, and I stated that this would be the most turbulent and dangerous period of his presidency, and it's turning out to be so.
Looking back at that book, what did, and again, you did not speak to, meet with, you did not actually treat the president, but what diagnosis would you consider for President Trump?
Yes, I think there's a lot of confusion about the word diagnosis. We have assessed the president in multiple areas that we can assess from a distance and should assess as part of our public health duty. But we have not diagnosed him because diagnosis is for patients. It is actually for their personal care. So it's not actually very important for the public. What's important for the public is whether or not he is dangerous and whether or not he is fit for duty to perform the duties of his office. And these we have evaluated.
And what was determined right from, again, 2017, obviously he was elected in 2016. He was out there campaigning by 2015. But what was the determination?
Yes, many people were speaking up at that time, many mental health professionals. And finally, when he was elected, I was not part of the earlier group, but the morning after election, I received a barrage of phone calls, emails from all kinds of individuals, contacts, but notably by civil society organizations and the public, because they knew of my work in violence prevention and asked if they should be concerned about this presidency. And I had to reflect myself before jumping in, but I've been fully immersed ever since, viewing this as a dangerous enough situation that we needed to speak about it.
And what was, and again, there were, I believe it was 27 mental health professionals, including yourself, with many years of background in these fields. What were the factors that you were able to see from afar that made you determine that the president or president-elect, I guess, over the time and then became president, was dangerous?
Yes, I generally, violence is my area of specialty, and I am mostly involved in violence prevention work, primarily using public health methods. And so when we're looking at an individual who is in an important position, such as the presidency, we're not just looking at the individual, we're looking at the entire situation. So he was already showing signs of danger. including verbal aggression. He had boasted of sexual assaults. He was inciting violence at his rallies. He was showing an attraction to violence and powerful weapons. And he, since the presidency, had taunted enemy and allied nations alike, including nuclear powers. And so all of these are signs of dangerousness.
When you say danger, and even though you're describing it, danger, it seems, can take on many different degrees and levels, right?
Yes. But actually, these different forms of danger are interrelated. So someone who is verbally aggressive and sexually violent are very prone to commit other forms of violence, either through violent acts themselves, or more likely from a position of presidency, through the incitement and stoking of violence in others, because he has vast power and influence to be able to do that.
So if he were being treated, would it be a matter of medicine? What would be something that would have had to been done?
So for danger, we start with containment. We remove them from access to weapons. We contain the person, actually fully contain the person, and only release to the extent that they show themselves to be safe. In other words, we try to find the minimal amount of constraint that is necessary for the person to be safe.
So it would seem, as a layman, it would seem that someone who is deemed danger or a dangerous person and becomes the most powerful person in the free world, that's a bad two ingredients put together. That is not something that you would like to see happen.
Absolutely. The combination is what is dangerous and deadly. And that is why we have emphasized that a dangerousness evaluation does not happen in person. It is about the situation, the overall situation of the power the person possesses with their personal characteristics and the weapons they have access to. And if the same individual were not in the office of the presidency, he may not have been as dangerous.
So you obviously put this out as a red flag. He was early in the presidency. What was the biggest concern for the president and for Americans?
My greatest concern at the time was that if we had a psychologically dangerous president in that powerful office, then the psychological dangers would grow into social, cultural, geopolitical, and civic dangers, which have already occurred. In fact, he has met our expectations, unfortunately, every step of the way, by both magnitude and timing.
So I want to ask you more again about where we have gone since election night. You seem to say that he, in effect, telegraphed this from the beginning.
Yes.
There seems to be a little confusion. A lot of people, and you're not saying it, but a lot of people have referred to his actions, tweets and press conferences and rallies as being delusional, and you're not necessarily saying that, right? I guess that's more of a diagnosis.
It's not a diagnosis, but it is a symptom that requires a personal evaluation. So it's hard to say whether or not he is in fact delusional, but there are signs of it. He appears to go in and out of it. In other words, there are signs that what he believes in are actually believed against any strategy or rational explanation. And we can also assess through his influence on his followers. In other words, delusions are much more effective at garnering fervent, irrational support from followers than any kind of rational strategy or simple misinformation.
Is there a confusion between, again, the idea, the possibility of this delusional state with also the idea that Trump could actually know precisely what he's doing? For example, he has been receiving ongoing money for a possible future campaign. I believe he has at least $200 million since the election that he's gotten. Do you think that there's a possibility that this is all a ruse, that he knows exactly what he's doing?
somewhere deep down, he actually knows exactly that he has lost the election, and he, more than anyone, will have known that. He is of the personality structure that he would not even believe, and he still may not believe that he's a legitimate president, or in fact, that's not something he can admit, which is the reason why he must overcompensate and make up for that sense of inner feeling of intolerable levels of inadequacy and incompetence and worthlessness. And so it's the fight against those feelings that is driving much of his behavior. And as I said, actual pathological symptoms can be more effective than rational strategy. So we should not so much try to isolate how effective is he in terms of how impaired we would deem him to be. In other words, someone who is mentally impaired is not simply disabled and less functional and presents exactly how impaired they are. In fact, many impaired individuals can present even more competently and present themselves flamboyantly and in a grandiose manner that would seem very charming or charismatic. But the problem is that if it's arising from a disorder and arising from impairment, that is impairment of the higher functioning, so that they're really behaving from a lower level, more primitive drive, then they may be, in fact, far more effective in the public sphere. But the problem is that it always ends up being dysfunctional and leads to destruction and damage. I compare this often to a car without working brakes. It may seem to be going faster than the other cars and more effective in speeding past others, but at the bottom of the hill, it will inevitably crash. And that is why it's important to distinguish what is disorder from what is rational, well thought through, organized thinking.
Well, a lot of what you're saying with disorder, is that also a narcissist?
Yes, he shows pathological narcissistic traits, yes.
And what about a sociopath? Does he have those traits as well?
Yes, he does. And those are the two primary tendencies. They're not diagnoses. Tendencies I have described, but they're not the only tendencies. He has a lot that is wrong with him.
If family members, we've seen aides, the majority of the Republican Party are staying with him, it seems, right to the bitter end. I guess enabling him, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
To that end, what about Trump's behavior that enables his followers to be in such a state of denial?
Yes, that's part of the pathology. In fact, we often don't think of mental symptoms as being contagious, but they're often described as contagious because they spread almost like a viral disease from an influential position where a severely mentally impaired person is allowed vast amounts of exposure to the public. Then in fact, it's far more contagious because you don't need physical exposure for the symptoms to transmit. You only need emotional bonds. And what are the symptoms that are most infectious? They include delusions. As I described, they can spread more rapidly than simple misinformation, paranoia, or the fear that others are after oneself and one has to protect oneself against others, and violence proneness. So aggressive behavior and violent behavior are very contagious, modeling very much after the guidelines that a powerful person is giving out. So what happens in these situations is that the secondary person taking on these symptoms can very soon appear as if they have the primary disorder themselves. It's a very dramatic phenomenon in clinical settings, usually occurs in families and gangs that I have treated, but we're seeing the same phenomenon at national scale, which is rare.
Instead of enabling, it would almost seem as though family and others, but especially family, should be providing an intervention of sorts.
Yes, and that is why oftentimes when severe conditions go untreated, it is dangerous because it's not the healthy individuals who are able to make the sick person better, but actually the sickness that spreads to healthy individuals so that they can sometimes take on very bizarre beliefs, which I have experienced in patients' families. One might have schizophrenia, for example, with very bizarre delusions, and it gets transmitted to the rest of the family until usually an outside person, the treater, intervenes and hospitalizes the primary individual. And then just as dramatically, the rest of the family returns to its normal state.
Did you read, I think I saw you did an interview with Mary Trump, who did a whole analysis of his upbringing. I'm just curious, just a quick overview from anything from that you learned from genetically that surprised you?
Nothing really surprised me. It gave more information, somewhat like the rest of the books of officials who left the White House, or so she was giving a family perspective. What's important to note is that it's not so much the type of information that is important, such as whether it's from within the family or within the White House, but rather the context that mental health professionals are able to bring to that information that gives us a special analysis. So by that time, we had plenty of information on the president over decades, an excessive amount of information. So it didn't add particularly, but I did appreciate her psychological sensitivity as a PhD in clinical psychology.
And it helps, I'm sure, to link back. It's almost like a family tree going back to his parents, his uncles and grandfather. And it just puts a clearer picture.
Yes, indeed.
We've been hearing this even since earlier in the term, but even more so now. Should the president be removed with the 25th Amendment? Is that something that should be a possibility?
Yes, we have put out a prescription for survival, we have called it, prescriptionforsurvival.org is on our website, since March, stating that the president needed to be removed from his position regardless of the means. And we have stated as options the 25th Amendment, impeachment, resignation, or an involuntary evaluation, as would be the standard of care, or if he cannot be removed, that his influence be removed. And we stated certain methods doing that. And we said so from a medical perspective, because whether or not it's the 25th Amendment or any particular means is a political decision, not a medical one. But the need for removal was clear for us since then, and we stated so in knowledge of the pandemic that was coming. And currently we would say the same, noting the election crisis we are going through. Just before the election, more than 100 senior mental health professionals came on video record to state that the president was too psychologically dangerous and mentally unfit to continue in the presidency or be a candidate for re-election. And so we were essentially stating that both of those were unacceptable at that point in terms of the risk it would bring.
Well, the one thing you got was obviously he lost the election. So one way or another, he'll be leaving in about a month and a half. Does that give you enough peace of mind?
Certainly, that was an incredible accomplishment on the part of the people. Despite all odds, I have mentioned all the psychological obstacles people had before them. And the fact that he has not been impeached and removed, or removed by the 25th Amendment, or not contained in any other way, which would be a proper procedure, not voting, because this is not a political issue and not not an electoral issue. It's truly a medical emergency, as well as a national security issue. But unfortunately, it was left to the people, and the people rose to the occasion and did an incredible deed by removing him. But as you're seeing, he has ways of subverting and avoiding and possibly even damaging the electoral results. The conclusions are not out yet.
And damaging, I guess, democracy as a whole.
Exactly.
I mean, norms with this president are completely out the window, as you know, but with this lame duck session, this lame duck period, it's, I guess that goes right back to what you said before about it being a dangerous situation where he can, in effect, do anything he wants.
Yes. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, and we're having Pearl Harbor level casualties on a daily basis. A little earlier, we were having 9/11 level deaths on a daily basis. And this is without counting the other dangers that he is stoking and bringing us closer towards, such as a war with Iran, international war. He has made nuclear war more likely through his policies over the last 4 years. And he can still instigate some national crisis. He has shown that he's willing to stoke violence in the population through civil unrest, and his former national security advisor recommending some kind of military supervised revote and therefore martial law. There are many things that he could still make possible, or at least disrupt enough that we would be in such chaos and destruction that that the damages will be great.
And Doctor, I want to ask you, even if the president, and we know he'll be gone in a few weeks, one way, whether he likes it or not, even if he has to be pulled out physically, he will be out by Inauguration Day. There have been rumors that he will run immediately, pivot to a 2024 election campaign and not concede. Is that troubling?
Yes, and that is where our current containment will determine whether or not he feels that he can continue to bring attention to himself and continue to wreak havoc as well as come back, which is also a possibility. He'll be working toward that possibility. But we need to make clear that that's not acceptable and that cannot happen. In fact, a colleague of mine, Dr. James Marikangas, a fellow forensic psychiatrist, and I recently wrote an op-ed stating how important it is to prosecute Donald Trump once he leaves office, because that will clearly set boundaries. It will help contain him, and containment and limit setting are truly the important aspects of treatment and the beginning of healing for our society, as well as a favor for him, in fact.
By the way, do you think that's part of the reason why he's refusing to allow the election to take its natural course, is because he figures if he leaves, he has a chance to get indicted?
I don't think he's as strategic as that, but psychologically, I do not think he has the ability to accept a loss. So I think he would have denied it in any case.
I want to ask you about the Goldwater rule. That's supposed to keep psychiatrists and mental health professionals, I guess, from making determinations about elected officials and those running for office. And I guess that started with Barry Goldwater running in 64, I guess it was. So how does what you've been doing and your colleagues, how is that permitted, I guess?
We actually have not broken the Goldwater rule because we have not stated anything that we cannot from a distance, and we have not diagnosed the president. But the American Psychiatric Association actually changed the longstanding definition of the Goldwater rule to not only cover diagnosis, but any comment on any objective part of the president's behavior. Actually, they should have known that that would violate our societal responsibility and therefore our core tenets of medical ethics, but they changed it to be to stay in favor of this administration, and they received the federal funding that they were looking for in response to that. A couple investigative articles have come out showing how they have misled the public and silenced experts in order to protect their federal funding. A prominent one was published in the New Statesman, but that's in the UK. And as you can see, no American newspaper journal has been able to touch the issue, and they still seem to have a lot of influence. I recently wrote an article that I simply posted on Medium about the Goldwater rule, because it's puzzled me. It meets no rational, ethical, practical reasoning, because if anything, it should have been invalid since 1980, when we started diagnosing by external observation rather than introspective interviews. So even diagnosis should be permitted from a distance, and yet, and they themselves have been performing evaluations, full evaluations, including diagnosis, from a distance on foreign leaders for over 70 years. So why is it only prohibited for the public to find out and know? It has recently dawned on me as a public, a member of the public wrote to me a very thoughtful question about it, that it is essentially to protect protect the power structure and prevent the public from holding it accountable. Because why would it be prohibited, and why would it take precedence over our primary responsibility to society? People don't recognize it often, but our primary responsibilities are to patients as well as to society. So we have a direct responsibility to protect societal health and safety. We don't have a primary responsibility to a public figure who is not a patient.
And to be clear, the book and any other writings, interviews about the president, you're saying that this has been a service that you've been giving?
Yes, we consider it a professional responsibility in line with our ethics guidelines that state that we participate in activities that improve the community and better public health. And also included in it is to consult with the three branches of government, the executive, judiciary, and legislative branches of government, in order to serve, share our knowledge, and serve the public. So the American Psychiatric Association, unfortunately, has been on the wrong side of medical ethics and history in compromising, in choosing to compromise under this administration for political reasons, not medical reasons, because medically, scientifically, and in terms of trends of practice, we've been going in the opposite direction as the one they promoted.
Well, I want to thank you so much for a few minutes. This has been very insightful. You know, it's a little scary out there, but
it is.
Dr. Bandy Lee, a faculty member of Law Psychiatric Division of Yale School of Medicine. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Listening on an Apple device, I hope you'll leave a review and a 5-star rating. If you have a comment about this or other episodes, you can reach me on Twitter at Jerry Barmash. Drop me an email, hearnowthenewsjb@gmail.com, and connect on my Hear Now the News Facebook page. Premium content from episodes available on my Patreon Hear Now the News Facebook page. Next time, a special way to end the year. We'll take a breather and celebrate getting through such a difficult 2020. A fun episode is planned, chatting with longtime Simpsons writer Michael Price. We'll talk about Homer and the gang, his favorite episodes of TV's longest-running primetime show, and writing for his favorite character. We'll end 2020 with a smile or even a laugh. Thanks for listening to Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Barnash.